You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Grassroots, listener-supported, solar-powered radio broadcasting live from the Cultural District here in Fairfield, Iowa. And actually, sometimes we're not broadcasting live, but sometimes we are. And this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilbourne.
And hello, everyone. I hope it's a nice day today. Since it is today, and I hope when you hear this, it's going to be nice.
Yeah, we've been
well.
Having a beautiful, sunny winter.
Oh, my.
Well, we had a gray winter, but then it got warm and sunny, so yes. We've been pretty happy lately. Mom, who do we have on Writers' Voices today?
Today we have Sue Klebold, and it was a very difficult book to write, and it was a little difficult to read, although it was very well written, I thought.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So if the name of this author rings a bell, there's a reason for that.
Yeah.
The title of the book is A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy. And Sue is the mother of Dylan Klebold, one of the two shooters at Columbine High School in 1999 who killed 13 people before ending their own lives, a tragedy that saddened and galvanized the nation. And Sue has spent the last 17 years excavating every detail of her family life and trying to understand the crucial intersection between mental health problems and violence. Instead of becoming paralyzed by grief and remorse, she's become a passionate and effective agent working tirelessly to advance mental health awareness and intervention. And this is very important. And I know there's people here in Fairfield that have been working on this too. We had, I hate to say it, but a rash of suicides in recent years, teen suicides. And people are really saying we need to step up and pay attention to this.
Well, part of that too is this social media thing that, bullying and so forth.
Yeah, and I think Sue will probably have something to say about
yes,
that.
She
Welcome to Writers' Voices, Sue.
Thank you very much.
So let me start out by saying that this must have been a terribly difficult book to write. How did you do it?
No, it wasn't that difficult to write because writing was so therapeutic for me. The experience was difficult to live through.
Mm. Obviously.
But, yes, but writing about it was something that was helpful to me. It was, I have always been a person, even as a child, somebody who kept a journal. And over my life, on and off, during the years that have passed, I have kept books about just writing because I found it helpful to me. And in fact, this is a place where I might even read a section of the book where I talk about this. I don't know if this is
let's do that. Sure,
not,
sure. Let's read to us what you wrote about writing.
Yes, absolutely.
All righty. After Columbine, the relief I got from writing felt almost physical, if temporary. My diaries became the place for me to correct the myriad, often contradictory feelings I had about my son and what he had done. In the earliest days, writing allowed me to process my tremendous grief for the sorrow and suffering Dylan had caused. Before I could reach out personally to the families of the victims, the journals were a place for me to apologize to them with all of my heart, and to grieve privately for the losses they had sustained. The diaries were also a place for me to set the record straight. In the immediate aftershock of the tragedy, we weren't mourning simply Dylan, but also his very identity and ours. It was impossible to correct the floods of misinformation in the media, but I wanted to tell our side of the story, if only in private. The pages of my notebook became a place for me to silently respond to the people who called us animals and monsters, to correct misapprehensions about my son and our family. Some of those pages reflect my feelings of defensiveness and even anger for those who judged us without knowing us. I was not proud of those feelings and was glad to keep them hidden, but they were necessary for me at the time, and I see the details I obsessed over as unwitting testaments to the shock and grief I was feeling. Writing in my diary also allowed me the space to reflect on my own loss. I did not feel safe enough to speak about it openly. So that pretty much sums up what writing did for me. And it was not a difficult decision to write. The difficult decision was whether or not to publish, knowing the responsibility I would be taking on to make myself public and to share this story. That was far more frightening for me.
Mm-hmm. I bet. Now, the book has now come out in paperback. It previously was published in hardcover. So you've had some time to adjust to being in the spotlight that way, haven't you?
I have, and it's something that I sort of took incrementally. I have worked with wonderful publishers who worked with me, tried to honor all of my needs and wishes, and it has been very difficult for me to be public, as I understand magnitude to whatever degree is possible of what my son did and the tremendous suffering he caused. And I don't want in any way to dishonor the other victims of the tragedy when I try to sort of unpack and understand what my son experienced and even talk about his death as a suicide, which to some people might be offensive.
Hmm. I do want to mention, and you have asked that, you know, whenever you're interviewed, that this be mentioned, that all profits from the book will be donated to research and to charitable foundations focusing on mental health issues.
That's correct, and right. That's all the author's profits.
All the author's profits, yeah.
Mm-hmm. All of my share will be donated because this enabled me to do something. I was hoping that by publishing a book, it would have some positive impact, and that is one of the things that I have been able to do, is to give money to the organizations that try to improve brain health, that do research, that try to offer education, advocacy, and this is something that's enabled me to do that.
Now, Sue, one of the things I found interesting, you talked in the book, you refer to brain disease and brain health as opposed to mental illness and mental health. Can you explain why you do that?
Yes, and that was something that one of the people I interviewed suggested, and that is the words mental health have been loaded with stigma and misunderstanding for so many years. I don't think most of us really have a very good idea of how to conceptualize what mental illness is, what mental wellness is in many cases. And by talking about it as a brain health issue, it puts it more into the context that our mental health is part of our health, that it is a part of our body that is having some dysfunction. And there are many ways that we can help with this problem, only one of them being medication, another being counseling, another being certain activities that we can do to alleviate our own distress and levels of depression. So to me, thinking of it as a brain health issue makes it more tangible and concrete.
I when I read that, it's sort of like made sense to me, mm-hmm. because the brain is, you know, a physical, tangible, physiological part of ourselves, where, like you say, mental, what does that mean?
Right.
that's right. And of course, there's so the brain is so complex that it's, I don't suppose they'll ever fully understand how it works or any, you know.
Yeah, there's been a lot of, and I know you did a lot of research on brain health and brain disease for the book. Was this something that you were interested in previously?
No, it was not. It was the tragedy and my own personal response to it that made me feel compelled to learn about this. I believe that, and the experts have supported this, that, you know, Dylan was not in his right mind at the end of his life, that he was not well, and that something about what was happening with him had made him lose access to his own tools of self-governance and reason. And when people are in an advanced state of suicidality, such as he was, because we learned that he had written about suicidal thoughts a full 2 years before his death. Their ability to think with reason and logic the way the rest of us do is impaired. And it was hard for me to understand that until in the months following the tragedy, and the years actually following the tragedy, I began to have my own issues with what was possibly post-traumatic stress disorder. But I, 4 years after the tragedy ended, 6 years after the tragedy, I began to have really acute anxiety disorder and had panic attacks. And when I went through that experience and could see what it felt like to have a malfunctioning brain and to feel the experience of the brain and the body working together. If you've never had a panic attack, they're pretty awful things to experience. And what happens is, you know, your brain is working with your body to create biological responses to what's happening. You have hormones that increase. You have your fear creates more fear. When I went through that, it really opened my eyes to this larger issue of there are times when we're not functioning well and our thoughts are out of control and we do need help. And I don't think anything could have explained that to me more clearly than having gone through those issues myself.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, to me, anyone who does something, I mean, commits suicide or does something extremely violent, isn't in their right mind.
No, it's like, that's right.
It doesn't, it's hard, you know, you can't make a distinct, or I don't make a distinction, I guess, between one person and the next. It seems like to be able to do something like that, you have to be unbalanced. Hitler was unbalanced, you know, and even anyone who lynched somebody was unbalanced. You know, to me, the question I'm getting at is, do you believe there are people who are truly evil, or is anyone who acts that way, would you say, has a brain disease?
You know, I don't know the answer to that, and I have struggled with the answer to that. It was very hard for me to accept the explanation that my son was evil. So I will only speak in Dylan's case. You know, this was the cherubic child. This was my gifted little boy. He was a good child. He was in a gifted program at school. He was loving. He had friends. You know, for me to think of him as evil, I could not do it. I was not able to wrap my arms around that kind of thinking. I suspect that most, if not all, of the people we have thought of as evil, I suspect that there has been some extreme malfunction going on in their brains. That's what I believe. But what we have to be very careful of is we cannot draw the conclusion that someone who has a mental illness is necessarily dangerous, because we know that only a very small percent of those who have a mental illness are violent toward others. Most often, if they are violent at all, they are violent toward themselves. They are at a higher risk of suicide. We have much to understand about this, and I think we are with this issue sort of where we were with cancer about 100 years ago, right when it seemed so large that people never thought that we could get a handle on it. And we're not all the way there yet with cancer, but now we know there are many, many kinds of cancers, and even within the same organ in the body, there can be many kinds of cancers. And I believe that we are approaching that understanding of the brain and understanding the brain connection to our biology, our behavior, and our thinking. And I think it's coming. And in that sense, I think I don't believe that my own son was evil. I believe that he was ill.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Sue Klebold, author of A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy. And, you know, I think what my mom was saying at the beginning about it being the book being hard to read, it's because it's so tragic. You know, it's you just feel for you and your family mm-hmm. and your son and your other son and of course the other victims of that horrible tragedy. I don't know how you survived it, honestly.
You know, I look back very often and wonder how I did, but many of the things that help people survive losses are things that I was able to have in my life. I had love and support of family and friends. This is critically important for good mental health, good health in general. I had a driving need to try to understand, and one of the things that I was able to do was to get connected with other survivors of suicide loss. And over the years, I began to meet more and more people who had had tragic events in their lives, people who had lost loved ones to suicide or in murder suicides where their loved one had killed another person or more than one person before taking their own lives. I have met people with incarcerated family members. And what I have found is that this kind of a community creates an important level of support and understanding, because going through that kind of a loss is so devastating. You feel that you are on a planet that no one else has been on, that no one could possibly understand the depth of your confusion and your loss and your pain. But when you begin to meet other survivors of other difficult kinds of loss, it gives you a tribe and a community, and you begin to sort of look out for each other, and it gets you out of yourself and moves you along toward healing.
Chris, one of the problems is, it's just a normal reaction that, and we do it all the time, we tend to blame the parents when a child, you know, does something.
And Sue's very honest about that in the book, that before this happened, that you did that as well, that would have been your first reaction, so you understood.
Yes.
You understood that reaction.
You know, I had always believed that myself, and that was one of the things that was hard for me to comprehend, was that, you know, if I had heard something in the news where somebody's son or, you know, child did something awful, you know, my first thought was, how was that kid raised? You know, where were the parents?
Yep.
I thought that way. And then all of a sudden, when this happened to me, and people have to realize that an event such as this is so rare, the likelihood that this could happen to someone is one in millions. But when it did happen to me, it shook all those old belief systems, and I began to realize that everything that I had believed up to that point was naive. It was wrong. I had always believed that love really had protective factors, that if you loved somebody deeply enough and they had a good relationship with you, you would know what they were thinking and feeling, that they would feel connected enough to you not to certainly ever take their own lives, let alone hurt someone else. But, you know, these things, I realized that I was wrong, that when someone is suffering deeply, they are in their own universe. And you might tell them you love them. You might hug them. You might say what you believe are all the right things to say. But they may be working very hard not to show you what is going on inside their troubled minds for whatever reason, whether they have fear or shame. And, you know, we just can't always know what our loved ones are thinking and feeling.
You know,
those beliefs that we can and that we do are, they're a false sense of security. They're not really real.
And, you know, in the case of a teenage mind, too, it's still developing. It's not fully developed. There's
been a lot of research about that, particularly adolescent males, that the brain is not fully developed till the mid-20s, and that some of the decisions that they make in those early years that can ruin their lives.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because they don't have the capacity, you know. Mm-hmm. So there's been some thought, and this is actually an issue that I'm involved in the criminal justice arena, that young people should not be sentenced to life in prison because of that, you know, that they should not be held responsible for their entire lives for the mistakes that mm-hmm. they make as teenagers.
Yeah.
Right, and I do support that as well, just from my own experience and what I have seen. Certainly.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, it's still, you know, there's still a tendency to say, how could you have not known that he was suffering?
Well, that is one of the questions that was certainly asked blatantly, loudly, blaringly at the beginning. Locally, one of the things that occurred right from the beginning was that our governor went on national media and said that the parents were responsible when something like this happened. So from a perspective of leadership, he was setting the tone that blaming the parents was not only okay, but correct. The thing that I never really had an opportunity to explain, and this is one of the reasons why I wanted to write a book, was that Dylan's behaviors were within the realm of what would be normal for a teenage boy. He was 17 years old. He had gotten in trouble a year before his death in junior year. He had scratched a locker at school. He had gotten suspended, been in trouble a little bit. He had gotten arrested. He and Eric had stolen something. I was dumbfounded. I was horrified. They were in a diversion program. They did beautifully. In fact, they had early release from the program. And I remember talking with Dylan at the time to say, you know, I don't know what this means. I don't know why this happened. You know, help me understand it. And he just said that it was an impulse, talking about the teenage brain again. And on his behalf, he said, I don't know why I did it. It was just stupid. And I'm going to show you that I'm going to get my life on track. And then he did. He had a job. He participated in school events like school plays. He did the sound for some of the school plays. He had applied to 4 colleges and universities and been accepted at all 4. We had just gone on a college visiting trip a few weeks before the tragedy happened. And the weekend before the tragedy happened, just 3 days before the shootings, he went to a prom with his friends. There were 6 couples in a limousine all dressed up. They went out for dinner. They went dancing. He came home and told me he'd had the greatest time of his life. He thanked me for making it possible. He talked with his friends that night about when they were going to all get together again. That day he had picked out his dorm room for college. He and my husband sat at a computer and Dylan measured the square footage to get the biggest room he could find. So these are not behaviors of someone who is apparently planning to end.
No, I mean it almost sounds.
Or someone else.
It almost sounds like he had a split personality.
Really?
Well, it does sound like that, and you know, really, what this is the thing that we wanted to explain, but we of course remained silent for years and years, was that very often people who are feeling suicidal will indicate those feelings. They may be very sad and tearful. You may see changes in their sleep patterns, either sleeping too much or not enough. They may talk about being a burden. They may say, I'm just more troubled than I'm worth. They may be giving away their possessions. These are all signs that someone might be thinking about dying. We did not see those behaviors at all. In fact, Dylan was talking about his future. He seemed invested in his future. There was no way for us to even think that he might be planning this. We never had guns in our home, yet he had secretly purchased guns. We didn't know that they existed. We didn't even know to look for them because they weren't anything we'd ever thought about. So these are the kinds of things that very often, and especially where suicides are concerned, very often family members don't know. Their treating psychiatrists or psychologists don't know. In some cases, we do know. And in some cases, people can be saved and they can be treated effectively. And in some cases, the treatment is not effective. So we have a lot to work on here.
Yeah, it seems like in many of the other cases of mass shootings, the perpetrator was diagnosed with a brain disease and on medication, or maybe not on medication, but and sometimes there's a tendency to blame the medications.
Right. Oh, yeah. That is one of the things that people do, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so it's sort of like you're kind of not allowed to use the words on the radio, but darned if you do and darned if you don't.
Right. Yeah.
Well, about medication, you see, not everyone reacts to medication in the same way. So it's very difficult to...
That's one of the challenges that we have
yes.
in treating, you know, brain dysfunction is that... Let's just take depression, for example.
Mm-hmm.
There are many different causes of depression. It can be a thyroid cause. It can be a circumstantial trigger. It can be, you know, there are just all these pieces to it that we don't yet understand. Medication is effective for some people. For others, it is not.
Right.
And I know certainly Dylan had never had a diagnosis and was never on any medication prescriptions, but his friend Eric had been. And he had taken himself off of those prescriptions. And we know that in many cases, doing that can increase suicidality also. So there is a lot of work that we need to do to sort out this giant jigsaw puzzle of wellness, of our wellness in our whole mind and our whole body, because it is not a simple thing, and it's not a one-size-fits-all situation.
Well, did Dylan's friends, were they aware of his suicidal impulses?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand
your
question.
Were Dylan's friends aware that he was suicidal?
Not one of his friends was aware that he was suicidal. In mm-hmm. fact, the friends that I've talked with can hardly accept it to this day, almost 18 years mm-hmm. later.
Wow.
Because it didn't make sense to them that you could be talking about your future and planning and talking about which muscle car you were going to show up at the next, you know, the next get-together group. They could not put that together. However, one of the things Dylan did show his friends that was a sign of suicide, that no one knew was a sign of suicide, was that he had purchased firearms. He had purchased guns. And a couple of his friends knew this, and he had sworn them to secrecy, would not allow them to talk about it. And in today's world, if young people find that they have a friend who has purchased something that could be used as a lethal weapon or a tool against themselves or someone else, many more kids today know that that is potentially a sign of danger. But nobody knew it back then.
Right.
And his friends... He asked them not to tell anyone, and they didn't tell anyone.
Now, he had asked you to purchase him a gun at one point, and you had said, no way. And he said, yeah, I thought you'd say that, remember?
He mentioned that to me in the last Christmas we had together. He said, you know, I have something to ask you, and I know what you're going to say. And mm-hmm. he said, would you get me a gun for Christmas? And I said, you know, of course not. I'm Dylan. You're 17 years old. I said, you're going to be an adult. If you want next year, if having guns in your life is something that you want to do when you are an adult, I can't stop you. But you know, I would never, ever, ever buy you a gun. And he smiled, and he said, yeah, I knew that.
Yeah.
I'd ask. But, again, was that a sign? I didn't think it was a sign because I wasn't seeing any behaviors that indicated to me that he was distressed, suicidal, or homicidal. And but now I do know from my research that it's the acquisition of a firearm is a sign that someone may be contemplating use of it. So,
wow,
mm-hmm.
to be aware of.
But when you first heard about the shooting, there was a lot of confusion because
yes.
you didn't know if he had was one of the ones that had been hurt or you know in that. That was a really difficult time, too. The whole thing, well, the whole thing was difficult. I mean,
Yes, the day of the shootings, he had said goodbye that morning in a very odd way.
Mm-hmm.
I had gotten up very early. It was still dark. I was going to work. And he had to get up and go to an early morning bowling class that I usually woke him up for. Mm-hmm. And while I was getting dressed, I heard him bounding down the stairs really fast. And I opened my bedroom door, and the house was pitch black. He hadn't turned on any lights. And I heard him go down the stairs toward the door. And I yelled out, "Dill?" And all he said was, "Bye." And he opened the front door and slammed it and left and drove off very fast. Now, I was alarmed. I thought, something is bothering him. What could be bothering him? Again, I was not thinking anything life and death, because I hadn't had any indicators that made me think that. I thought, something is bothering him. He's in a hurry. You know, maybe he's meeting somebody for an early coffee before his bowling class, or it just, I didn't know what was wrong. But I was alarmed, and I woke up my husband, and I said, "Tom, you were right on the weekend," because Tom had said, "Dylan seems stressed. He said his voice is a little bit higher than usual." And I turned to him and I said, "You're right, something is bothering him. Will you be home today when he gets home from school so you can talk to him and get to the bottom of this?" And he said, you know, yes. He worked out of our home and he said he'd talk to Dylan. So I went on to work thinking that Tom would work this out with him and they'd visit, because they spent time together when Dylan came home from school regularly.
You know, that was interesting that he noticed that his voice cadence had changed.
He said the pitch of his voice is slightly higher than usual. I mean, it's such a minor little thing, and I said, "Really? I don't hear that." And I said, "And he is going to a prom this weekend, and he's, you know, maybe he's nervous about that." And Tom said, "Maybe that's it." But it was such a little thing, and we didn't put these pieces together.
Sue, why don't you read the beginning of chapter 3?
Beginning of chapter 3.
Yeah, Someone Else's Life, those first couple of pages.
Find chapter 3.
Six. And this is Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. And our guest today is Sue Klebold, author of A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy.
I think I could find the chapter quickly, but I can't.
Okay, it's page 32.
You know what? I'm in the big print version.
Glasses.
It's 32 in your book. I'm not sure. Let me get the other book, and that would make it easier for me to do that.
All right.
Hang on a minute. I have in my office here all different versions of this book. I have it in different languages, different sizes, different formats, so... Let me see, page 32, and I will have to put my glasses on.
How many languages has it been published in?
Well, I think it's about 11, 10 or 11.
Wow.
And it's been really remarkable, because it's in countries you wouldn't think would have it translated, but Russia, Korea, Portuguese, I think Japan. I mean, it's been really a surprising number of languages that I wasn't aware that a story that was so based on American culture would be of interest.
Well, you know, the thing is, people are people.
That's
and,
right.
You know, everywhere. And so things are universal around the world.
Yeah.
Yes.
Stress and everything else.
So this is the beginning of chapter 3, which is called Someone Else's Life. Journal entry, April 21st, 1999. That's the day after the shootings. Yesterday, my life entered the most abhorrent nightmare anyone could possibly imagine. I can't even write. The next morning, it felt as if I'd been dropped without warning into someone else's life. Just the month before, an old friend had come to town. Catching up over dinner, I told her my life had never been more satisfying. I had recently turned 50. I had a loving husband and a marriage that had withstood 28 years of ups and downs. Byron was fully supporting himself and sharing an apartment with a friend. Dylan had recovered from an episode of trouble in his junior year and had done a great job of getting back on track. He was heading into the home stretch before graduation, hanging out with his friends and planning for college. I even had a little free time to draw and paint. The single biggest worry in my life, I told her, was the declining health of our beloved elderly cat, Rocky. On April 20th, 1999, I woke up an ordinary wife and mother, happy to be shepherding my family through the daily business of work, chores, and school. Fast forward 24 hours, and I was the mother of a hate-crazed gunman responsible for the worst school shooting in history. And Dylan, my golden boy, was not only dead, but a mass murderer. The disconnect was so profound that I could not wrap my head around it. Over the course of that first night in Don and Ruth's basement guest room, I had come to accept that Dylan was dead. But Tom and I were still in complete denial that he could have taken the lives of others. More than anything else, this is what stands out about those early days in the aftermath of Columbine. The way we were able to cling in strange and stubborn ways to an unreality shielding us from a truth we could not yet bear. But those contortions could not protect us for very long from the wrath of a community we had come to love, or from the emerging truth about our son. Did you want me to keep reading?
Yes, yeah.
Okay. Don and Ruth were infallibly generous and kind, but they were utterly helpless in the face of our bewilderment and grief, as anyone would have been. I could barely speak. When I did open my mouth to make a comment, more often than not, I'd trail off mid-thought. The idea of eating was inconceivable. A fork looked like an alien instrument in my hand, and the mere smell of Ruth's delicious cooking made my stomach churn. I was exhausted, lower in energy than I'd ever been in my life, moving through the hours as if buried in wet cement. I dimly remember a worried Ruth covering me with an afghan as I lay motionless on her couch. Sleep provided only a temporary reprieve. The second I became conscious, I'd be crushed all over again by the enormity of what Dylan had done and by the senselessness of it. It's a cliche, I suppose, to say I was behaving like a zombie, but that is the closest description I have for the way I felt in those early days. Under normal circumstances, if any circumstances involving the death of a child can ever be called normal, we would have called family members and friends to share the awful news. They would have gathered to grieve with us, to offer support. We would have been kept busy readying the house for visitors, and friends would have come bearing stories, poems, and photographs to honor Dylan. These coping mechanisms in the face of grief are time-honored and shared across many cultures because they are effective. They give families comfort at a time when very little can. For us, nothing could have been further from normal than our lives during the days following Dylan's death. Almost everyone who'd ever known us knew of our son's connection to the Columbine tragedy within hours of it happening, but they couldn't get in touch with us because we had fled for our lives. Horrified family members and friends who called our home that afternoon either received no answer or found themselves talking to the law enforcement officials still searching our house. Clearly, we couldn't have any of our out-of-state family members or close friends come to Littleton to be with us. Even if we had anywhere for them to stay, we couldn't guarantee their safety. In hiding at Don and Ruth's house, we were insulated from how frightening the situation in the community was. We wouldn't really know how much danger we'd been in until I read about one of Tom's long-lost cousins in the paper. He was going public to say he'd never met Dylan and begging people to stop sending him death threats.
Wow.
48-hour period following the shootings, a cluster of family members received more than 2,000 phone calls from media and members of the community. Not all were threatening, of course. Even in the immediate aftermath, people reached out in support. But it was still unimaginable. A local reporter tried to push his way into my 85-year-old aunt's home in Ohio. She was proud she'd stood up to him by asking him to leave, so she insisted he take a fresh-baked cookie with him.
That's a good place to stop.
Okay.
So I don't understand. Why would people threaten someone? It's like, it doesn't even make sense to me.
Well, I you know, they believed that the parents, in raising this child, had caused this to happen. And we were viewed certainly not, if not perpetrators, accomplices. You know, they believed that Dylan was for whatever reason, either too spoiled, I was too lenient, I was too strict, that people like to believe that we were wealthy. I know there was a lot of bias in the media. They wanted to portray us as very wealthy people. For example, Dylan drove this little black car that happened to be a BMW. And when reports were written in the paper about our family, they would say Dylan drove his black BMW to work. But what they didn't say was that he and his dad had got it for $400 and they'd fixed it up in the garage to get it running, you know. So there was a bias that was hidden, and the stories that condemned us were so pervasive and easily picked up. People feel a sense of rage and wanting to do something after an event like this mm-hmm. happens. And for some people, just reaching out with hatred was what they felt they needed to do.
Wow. Now, you mentioned that one of the reasons that it was hard to decide whether to publish the book, and also, you know, writing it, you know, writing in your journal is one thing, but putting it into book format where it's coherent and cohesive and tells the whole story, you know, that's a lot of effort too. But one of the reasons that you were hesitant was not knowing how the other victims' families would react. How have they reacted?
Well, you know, we just as you can't take all family members of perpetrators, we can't assume there is any one general truth for all family members,
right,
victims of this tragedy. I am sure that there have been many, many reactions. I have tried very hard to not be public in the Colorado area. We have been very low-key about our publicity here because I think it's very re-traumatizing for people to know that this book exists, to know that I'm speaking about this tragedy. So that is the thing that I wanted to be very careful about. But on the other hand, a few more of the victims' families members have reached out to me, and I've been able to actually develop some friendships mm-hmm. from people who have been gracious and generous, and you know, feel that we are very much aligned in our desire to prevent things like this from happening ever again. So there is certainly a very broad span of reactions because every person is different and everyone is going to do something different with their own personal experience.
Those friends that took you into their home were certainly kind because, you know, they needed to, they sheltered you from.
And yes, and that was very fortunate. And actually, we were related to them, but they were not, you know, it was just somebody that was a relative. And they were able to take us in. And we really literally were in hiding. It had a mm-hmm. very much of an Anne Frank feel to it in those early days.
I'll bet.
Were afraid to, for example, if you have to go to a pharmacy and get a prescription, we weren't sure that we were safe if we said our name. If I would be in a doctor's office and waiting for my turn and they announce, you know, Mrs. Klebold next, for a very long period of time, probably to this day, I'm still very cautious. I look around and I, you know, realize that just hearing my name may be traumatizing for people. And I, you know, that's something that I have to live with daily.
You know, one of the there's a letter in the book, one of the kindnesses that you received were among, you know, many people who shared kind of stories about having hidden things from their parents as teenagers, or their teenagers hiding things from them, so you know that you weren't the only one who, you know, didn't notice something like this. There's a wonderful letter from a friend of the family.
Yes.
On page 102. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, and I don't know if you'd like me to read that. I'd be happy to. It was an incredible letter.
Sure,
One of the things that happened after this tragedy was that people were realizing that there is a hidden world that goes on before our eyes sometimes, and we don't know it, because certainly that's what they perceived that I had gone through. And at that time, people that we knew were suddenly beginning to disclose to their family members things that had happened to them when they were little that their parents had no idea about. I heard multiple stories about this. And they were very comforting because, you know, to take someone that you know who you believe to be an excellent parent and then you learn that one of their children had experienced something really difficult, it was in a bizarre way helpful to us to learn that we weren't the only ones who hadn't seen something that was in front of our faces.
Right.
And I want to just read this amazing letter from this incredible woman. It says, we also received a letter postmarked April 27th, 1999, which would be 1 week after the shootings, which I reprint here with the permission of the author, although I have changed names and places to protect the privacy of those involved. It came from Cindy Worth, a woman of about our age. Tom had known her family growing up and had stayed in touch with them through the years. We both admired the Worths. They were successful and happy, pillars of their church, good people, and I was always struck by how loving and close they were to one another. With real sadness and alarm, we read the following. Dear Tom, Sue, and Byron, forgive me for the length of this letter, but there is so much to say. I hope that by sharing my story with you, you will find some comfort and peace and better understand why Dylan didn't talk to you about the pain and anger he was suffering. Mom and Dad moved to Colorado when I was 14 years old. Almost from the start, I was harassed by a group of boys who called me Flipper because my nose is long. They would walk behind me in the school hallways and sing the theme song to the Flipper TV show. They hung used tampons and Kotex in my locker and stole letters from my notebook. They read unmailed letters to my friends back home in the boys' locker room before football practice. The culmination to the harassment occurred when I was raped by a football player. He boasted to his friends that it would have been better had he not looked at my ugly face. I never told Mom and Dad, not until a couple of days ago. I wanted them to know, and I want you to know, why I didn't tell them. It might help to understand why Dylan didn't talk to you about his problem. I felt a tremendous amount of shame about being a target of harassment and assault. I can tell you from firsthand experience that young people blame themselves for the pain they suffer. I believed there must have been something wrong with me for people to treat me this way. I wanted Mom and Dad to think the best of me. I assumed that if I told them what happened, they would think of me as I thought of myself, flawed and ugly. I was too young and confused to recognize what had happened was a crime. I thought that if I told anyone, the taunting would get worse. I suffered in silence for about 3 months, all the while becoming more and more depressed. I was contemplating suicide when I met someone who literally saved my life. Ken was a funny-looking, outgoing, joyful kind of guy, somewhat of an outsider himself, but it didn't seem to bother him. He sought me out and became my friend. After several weeks, I felt safe enough with him to tell him what happened. The sweet, gentle 14-year-old boy had enough wisdom to listen and hug me while I shed gallons of tears. Ken grew up to become a minister. He was and always will be my minister. This is what should have happened for Dylan. A friend, a peer, should have been there for him. A friend who could guide Dylan away from anger and depression, not feed it. Please know this. This friend could not have been you, Tom and Sue, as his parents, or you, Byron, as his brother. The process of growing up and separation makes it extremely difficult for children to seek out their parents and siblings for help with these hidden, painful problems. I believe with every fiber in my body and stirring in my soul that Dylan is with the Lord and that we will see him and rejoice with him again. I love you. We love you. We are lifting you up. Cindy. Mm-hmm. That is the letter we received from a remarkable person.
And that is Sue Klebold, who's reading from A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy. Sue, how much impact did bullying have on Dylan's mental health?
Bullying has a significant impact. We do know that bullying, the incidence of bullying, other kinds of shaming experiences, increase risk of suicide. The thing that gets confusing for people is when I hear people say bullying causes suicide. Bullying does not cause suicide. Breaking up with your girlfriend does not cause suicide. Getting fired from your job does not cause suicide. But these things that happen in our lives that increase our pain, increase our shame, increase our disconnection from others, they are called risk factors. They are things that make us at a higher risk of suicide. So if you take someone who is already at risk of suicide, who is probably experiencing depression, some other kinds of pathological thinking, and you put bullying into the mix, it only makes the situation far more dangerous for that person. And yes, I believe the bullying that both Eric and Dylan experienced together was probably the primary unifying factor that made them bond with this level of rage and unfulfilled revenge that they wanted.
Now, Sue, you don't talk a lot about Eric in the book. Did you ever connect with his parents?
No, I have spoken with them many times over the years. And my rule of thumb on talking about them or any of the parents, I've met many family members who have had loved ones involved in murder-suicides. And that is, as I was saying earlier, you know, we all process this differently. And in most cases, when a family member has done something as horrific as this, the family members want to have their own privacy. They don't want to be talked about. They don't want to be public figures. So I always respect the Harris's privacy, just as I do respect the privacy of the other family members that I've talked with, of other shooters that have been associated with some more high-profile events.
Did you, I know at first, before you really had all the facts, you blamed Eric for, you know, which is a natural response. What did it take to kind of back off from that?
One of the things that helped me was seeing, when I finally saw Dylan's writings, and I didn't even know he had written anything, I had looked and looked for a suicide note, I'd looked for something, but the police came into our home on the day of the shootings and took many things out of our home. And one of the things they took was some notebooks and pieces of paper that Dylan had placed in random places that expressed his own feelings. Mm. When I could see that he was talking about suicide, talking about being in agony and wanting to die, wanting to get a gun so that he could end his life, writing about this at the age of 15, even writing that he was cutting himself, I could see that Dylan himself was struggling with the weight of these deep, dark thoughts and feelings, and that Eric was a very different person, and I didn't study Eric in any depth. Eric had a completely different set of circumstances going on with him psychologically. And it was almost like a chemical bond, that in these two opposing personalities, they fulfilled some kind of a need. Eric's writings revealed that he was very outwardly hostile. He was extremely homicidal in his writings, real graphic viciousness. Dylan's writings were much more internal and sad and longing, and he wanted a girlfriend. But I think, you know, there was any relationship is, you know, it's a two-way mechanism. You know, for some reason, these two boys connected. And, you know, to say that Eric was responsible entirely would be foolish of me, because Dylan did take part. He did respond to this idea and did plan. And it just wouldn't be true if I could hold Eric completely accountable for that.
Yeah, I definitely. But it must have been very hard to come to that realization.
Every step of the way, every realization has been hard. Yes.
So what's next for you, Sue?
Well, you know, I really don't know. I have been, since the book came out, I've continued to be involved with the mental health and suicide prevention movement and community. I am doing some speaking now, and I am on some national advisory councils for some of the organizations. I'm for the American Foundation Suicide Prevention on their Loss and Healing Council. For the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, I'm on their Consumer Survivor Advisory Committee. And I want to continue to do this, whatever I can, to do this kind of work. And that's all the farther I can see in front of my face right now. I don't know where all this is leading, or at some point I will just try to find something else to do. I think we have a very troubled world right now, and I think there is so much that needs to be done to help people.
Well, you're certainly be commended that you didn't just crawl into a shell and grieve, that you're reaching out and you're going to help other people that might find themselves in this position.
It requires such courage to put yourself out like that.
Oh yes,
it's.
I probably would disagree with that and just say that for most of us, being able to do something for someone else is just really a gift that we give ourselves. And
that's true.
That my reasons are selfish in that regard. Helping others is something that makes me feel more worthwhile.
I understand that, and I do want to mention again that all author profits from the book will be donated to research and to charitable foundations focusing on mental health issues. And for more information, you can visit Sue Klebold's website at www.amothersreckoning.com. And we are out of time today. I want to thank you, Sue, for being with us and taking this time to be with us today.
Thank you very much, both of you. It's been a pleasure to speak with you.
And, Mom, do you have some closing words of wisdom for us?
Yes, I do. I would like to urge everyone today to practice empathy. Just to see how it feels for the next 24 hours, refrain from criticizing anybody or anything.
All right. That's your challenge for the day.
Thank you very much.
And stay tuned now if you're listening on Friday for Planet Erstwhile with James Moore. And remember that we rebroadcast Monday morning. If you're listening on Monday morning, 8 a.m., 8 to 9 Central, I hope you have a wonderful week. And see you next week on Writer's Voices. Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com.